I'm Chris White, and this is the Electric Jesus Podcast. Let me set the scene for you. You finally get an interview to run sound for your favorite local Christian metal band.
So, what kind of music do you listen to?
Quite a bit, actually. Love metal, hard rock. Love your guys' stuff. I've been listening to Res Band, Barren Cross, Blood Good, Leviticus, Jerusalem, Messiah Prophet, Philadelphia, Barnabas, Daniel Band, Shout, and Saint, which I think is the heaviest of them all, of course.
You can't stop. You just keep going on, naming bands.
I love the 77s, that whole post-punk new wave scene, bands like Youth Choir, The Lifesavers, and LSU, which is the new version of The Lifesavers, and it's insane. Undercover, Vector, Charlie Peacock, Bill Mason Band, Mad at the World, Andy McCarroll and Moral Support, The Technos in 3D, Quick Flight, 441, Steve Taylor and Daniel Amos, of course, and even punk stuff like The Lead and this new underground band from Texas that I heard about at Cornerstone called One Bad Pig.
On and on and on.
You know what I really love is when I find a regular band, you know, like on MTV and the radio, that just has like a Christian perspective on things. I've been really into Bob Dylan, The Alarm, Simple Minds, The Call, After the Fire, Bruce Coburn, Violent Femmes, this wicked metal band from Chicago called Trouble. Alpha Band, they actually backed up Dylan. And Kaja, that's what was left after the lead singer left Kaja Goo Goo. It's way cooler. And U2, of course.
Until finally, you're done.
That's just what I carry around with me. I've got a lot more at home.
What was the third one again?
Welcome to season two of the Electric Jesus Podcast. I'm your host, Chris White, writer, director, and producer of the 2021 rock and roll comedy, Electric Jesus. Last season, we went behind the scenes to discover the music that inspired the world of Electric Jesus and the amazing work our team did to create an all-new soundtrack for the film. This season, I've selected 9 key scenes from the film to talk about with fellow artists, authors, academics, pastors, old friends, and new. There will be spoilers. So if you've not yet seen the film, I encourage you to watch it. It's streaming all over the place. Just Google it. Or better, click the link to our streaming partners in the show notes. And if you have seen the film, well, I mean, I'm guessing that since you're listening to this, the film connected with you in some way. I'm glad. And I hope that these conversations add to your enjoyment and appreciation of Electric Jesus.
Episode 2. Jesus Music Revolution.
Okay, so I met Mike Norman when Electric Jesus launched our U.S. Film Festival run. I think, if you tell me, Mike, I think you reached out to me or Electric Jesus on social media, and we had a really cool chat about the movie. Is that is that your memory?
Yeah, I think Emily responded first and then kind of connected us.
Yeah, yeah, because you have a different name online, which
I
is it's amusing. And so I was like, well, I don't know who this guy is. But then, and we'll just get this out of the way, your dad was Larry Norman.
Yeah.
Who, if anybody's listening, doesn't know that name and can't Google that name, Larry Norman is kind of like, he's like Christian rock's Elvis and the Beatles combined, maybe. Is that fair? Is that a good summation of?
I think so. Definitely credited as being a foundational figure.
Yeah,
for sure.
Right. Mike's a normal, very normal, sweet, loving guy. He's happily married, and he and his wife Tiffany now have a beautiful little girl. I think you were expecting when I met you in 2020. Yep. And he's focused most of his life and free time on social work, supporting people in need. And honestly, maybe the most Larry thing about you, at least on the surface, is the fact that you occasionally act in films and consult on music projects. And also have great empathy, and it's fun to talk to you about stuff. So thank you for talking to me, particularly about the scene in Electric Jesus where our hero pretty much checks all the Christian music boxes
in that. Yes. And then some.
So let me just start here, and not like you're the, I don't want to hold you up as the, you know, a musicologist breaking down the origins of Christian rock and roll, but
Thank you.
Christian rock and roll came from a good place, yes, or at least maybe a pure or well-intentioned place.
I mean, I think the answer is definitely yes. And even if music that predates the artists that Eric lists in the scene, I mean, it definitely comes from like a black gospel choir kind of background, you know. So, I mean, it's always been an incredible expression of just the joy of having a relationship with God and wanting to share that with others. So I would say it definitely came from a great place. And a lot of the artists, you know, in Eric's list for multiple decades, I think they carried that forward.
And then in the late 60s, mid to late 60s, we start having an emerging kind of with the everything happening in the 60s, sexual revolution and hippies and drug scene, all that kind of stuff. There seems to appear naturally, it kind of comes from California where all the weird stuff comes from. But there seems to be like a moment that happens where whether people are trying to reform themselves, they're having hard lives with choices they're making, or it's just in the air. There's a spiritual openness. But it seems like that's when people like Larry start popping up, which they kind of talk about a little, a corner of that in the Jesus Revolution, a very popular movie that was recently out this year, which you acted in. You appear in that movie. Okay, two things. I got to ask you, one, how did that happen that you appeared in the movie? Yeah. And then I'm going to ask you what you thought of that movie.
Well, yeah, so the connection actually came through the same trip that I met you and your wife and the G's team. So I was originally flying out to Nashville just to connect with Kevin about another project that we can talk about later. But he did a tribute / cover record of Larry's most popular record, Only Business.
This is Kevin Max. Kevin Max.
Yes, Kevin Max. And I'm sorry,
of
Kevin Max.
DC Talk.
Of DC Talk. Yeah. And so we were just connecting to kind of do a soft launch of that project and do some social media things. And it was really by chance that I saw that your film was doing the circuit. The timing was just perfect. So that's how we got connected. And at the very same time, Kevin had just finished being interviewed himself for a movie called The Jesus Music, which was, you know, kind of a collection of the history of CCM music packaged nicely with lots of interviews. And it really came out of the pandemic. You know, people stuck at home and all these artists that usually are touring weren't able to tour. So their production company was able to put together this documentary and interview a lot of people. And I happened to be in town when they had an opening and kind of rode on Kevin's coattails and got to do a day of interviewing myself. So that's how I met their team. And then from there, I've stayed in touch with some of the producers, just checking in on projects and things. And just they brought up the Jesus Revolution movie coming up. And we just thought it'd be fun to throw in a kind of an Easter egg, you know, appearance of me in one of the scenes. So, yeah, it's just kind of a fun project we came up with together.
Based on true stuff, was that... How do you interpret that movie's portrayal of the early days of, we keep saying CCM, contemporary Christian music.
Yeah.
Or specifically Christian pop or rock music.
Well, I definitely think there's pluses and minuses to the film. I mean, I think what it captured well was kind of the spirit of youth and the excitement and the revolution that a lot of young people were feeling that were creating this music as well as the culture. It's not so heavily focused on the music. I mean, they definitely bring in some context about love song and kind of the transformation of worship music and church becoming more accessible, going towards a folk rock direction. So that way, you know, kids coming off the streets from the hippie subculture could connect with churches more easily. So definitely talked about that a bit, but definitely did a good job of capturing youth and excitement and just, you know, really the possibilities that I'm sure young people at the time really felt could be the future for their nation, you know, how they could separate from things that were really painful and probably caused a lot of anger, such as the Vietnam War and some political things at the time. And I think at that age, sometimes you just feel you can change the world and that there's a utopian hope that you can pursue. So I think they captured just that life and that youth very well.
That's really, really well said. That's what that movie does best. And bringing, it doesn't completely bring this point in, the idea that where that baby boomers evangelical movement landed, or where we think of it now in 2023, was very different from where it started, and maybe even into the era of Electric Jesus, in even into the early 80s where it was going.
Yeah.
I mean, there was, it was kind of a different, I don't know. I don't think everything has to be political, but it feels like a lot of the early CCM stuff was, it just wasn't like what we think of when we think of evangelical politics today.
Yeah. And it was grassroots, you know, it wasn't about association with a party or association with a class or a status or anything. I mean, it was just very grassroots, very community oriented. And I feel like there was such a boom in the music portion of it because it hadn't become structured and corporate, and demographics hadn't been defined, and marketing hadn't happened yet. And I think artists and people that didn't even consider themselves artists yet, were coming together and learning from one another and sharing their experiences. And it came out in the music and in the culture that was created. But, you know, similarly to how the hippie movement and that time in the late 60s was a time of community and organic grassroots growth, the 80s was a time of economic boom. It was a time of a large political shift, more to the conservative side. You know, there was definitely a generation of voters and, you know, people that really had status and owned businesses and were movers and shakers, I think, in the economy and in the business world and in our communities. And so it was just kind of a perfect fusion of some of the naivete and hope that those young kids had faded away a bit, but they had still also accomplished so much during that time of excitement that now they were established and it was a time to capitalize on all of that growth. And I think that's when everything came together to create corporations and to create political interest groups and establish evangelical messaging. And it just kind of grew and grew from there, I think.
I got a suite at the Saigon Hilton, cocktail parties with Premier Key. We talk about how the war is going and watches color TV. 6 o'clock news, but what can I do? Drinking black market booze, what can I do? I'm red and white and true blue, what can I do? I am 6 o'clock news.
I kind of came, you know, of age during a second boom in Christian music, which was the 90s. Honestly, I would say a lot of CCM listeners today, if you can even call them that or call it a current industry, their nostalgic bands are more likely going to be the artists that I grew up with as opposed to the artists that Eric appreciated.
Right.
Which is a shame because there's been a loss of heritage and just the joy of the history of yeah. its development. And during that time, there was a lot of, you know, crossover agreements between secular and Christian mm-hmm. record labels. A lot of secular labels were swallowing up Christian labels because mm-hmm. they saw the profitability in the sales. Large festivals were developed and funded. And again, it became a bit blurry for those that were kind of at the top of the industry, I think.
Like who? Who would be those at the top? Amy Grant, DC Talk.
Audio Adrenaline.
Yeah, Newsboys.
Yeah, Newsboys, Jars of Clay. I mean, really the biggest darlings, honestly, probably would have been Switchfoot, maybe. And whether it's Your Music or Not, POD hit during that new metal phase in the secular scene. So they had some really successful crossover as well.
When Eric says those names of those bands, did any of them just like, oh yeah, I know about them, or Larry toured with them one time, I think.
All the bands that jumped out were the artists that really were from his time, kind of the pioneer.
I gotcha.
Randy Stonehill, Keith Green, All Saved Freak Band, Daniel Amos, of course.
Concrete Rubber Band. That's one of my favorites.
They were fun to hear. It was my first time, honestly, but they definitely intrigued me.
Very cool.
I mean, that's what kind of rang nostalgia for me, was just thinking about the bands that he was fond of, that he felt were kind of his peers. Definitely anybody on solid rock, Tom Howard.
So that was the label that Larry and Randy started, basically.
Yes, essentially, yes. So that was Larry's label.
And didn't those guys find Phil Keaggy?
Yeah, so, I mean, they were close for years. We even had dinner a couple times in Salem in the late 90s, early 2000s with Phil. Him and Larry stayed pretty close over the years. So anyway, I know they've known each other for a long time, but I'm not great with, like, the history of his origins. Yeah.
Did you listen to any of that stuff from the list? I guess you did. You made a playlist.
Yes.
Did you like any of it?
I definitely went a bit overboard. I listened to about 200 tracks. I got Anything You Want. I've got Hot Takes, The Good, The Bad.
I want it all. And we'll just say, if you are an artist who's listening to this, it's just some guy that just heard it and he's got a hot take. And so dismiss. And if you're a fan and this means so much to you, please don't get offended. I've already told you, Mike's the nicest, sweetest guy in the world. And no, this is not what Larry Norman thinks of your band or something. This is Mike Norman's official, unofficial take. So what do you think? Tell me about something. Okay.
So here's The Good, and I split up my genre as well.
Okay, The Good, yeah.
So for metal, my favorites were Barren Cross, Blood Good, mm-hmm. Leviticus, mm-hmm. and Saint. I would say Saint was probably my favorite.
Really? Okay, so you got into the Saint. Okay, very good.
Definitely dug Saint. But, you know, really what I enjoyed the most was I wasn't really familiar with the kind of the new wave post-punk sound.
Oh, right. Right.
So that's what stuck out to me. So I really, really enjoyed, of course, Mike Rohn, the 77s, who I had heard before. And Larry had a lot of respect for Mike. I know they stayed in touch over the years as well. Yeah. Undercover, Mad at the World, Lifesavers or LSU were great.
Yeah, I love that band. Oof.
Yeah, I think the choir really blew me away.
Oh.
Really hadn't heard them before, and they blew me away. So loved
them. Have you met those guys?
You know, so that's the thing is a lot of people always want to know, who I've met or haven't met. And I can name some, but I think my dad wanted my experience to be very normal. And so he would just say, hey, this guy is John. He plays music. And we would shake hands and talk on the couch for 20 minutes backstage somewhere. I didn't always know who they were with or if it was even an artist or a merch guy or no idea. I met hundreds of people behind stages for many years.
A lot of these people are just like, I don't know. I kind of went into the movie. I didn't know any of these. I'm just a fan, right?
Yeah,
like I knew
a
lot of the music, but I'd never really met the artist. And one of the pleasures of doing the movie was I got to meet a lot of the artists. And really, to a person, everybody was just, they were just great. They were people I'd want to be friends with. Like I wanted to go back and tell my young self, like, hey, yeah, yeah, like them, the altar boys. Those are good guys. Yeah. You know, like, so, you know, I didn't meet anybody that was, you know, awful. I remember we did a screening in California and Brian Duncan
came. Oh, yeah.
He's a solo artist and from Sweet Comfort Band. And
yeah,
I was like kind of terrified for a second. I was like, oh, he's here and he's going to watch the movie. And he was just delight. I mean, just wonderful. Just like a real artist and really into music and all the cool stuff you'd want him to be into, but also just super kind. And
wow.
So yeah, I didn't encounter anybody. And of course the Striper guys were fantastic because one, they let us do this movie for them.
Yeah.
You know, with their permission to use their songs and their images, but also just being around them and meeting them was every time was just superb. You know, we would see them play a few times and then we hung out with them and showed them the movie. And I don't know why I was so nervous about them seeing it, because they're treated well in the movie, I think, but
sure.
I was terrified. And they couldn't have been nicer. Okay, so hot take. Who did you not like? Who does not hold up? In Mike Norman's sense.
Okay. So I'll just blast through these in the metal category. Jerusalem, Messiah Prophet, Barnabas, Daniel Band, and Whiteheart, definitely.
What is it about Whiteheart you didn't like? They weren't really metal. I don't think of them as metal.
Yeah. And that gets a little blurry for me too, because what's metal and what's kind of the big hair movement.
Yeah.
And they definitely were more on the pop end of things.
Sure.
Too, for sure. I think for me, metal or hair or whatever, it's just a bit of a, the genre itself is kind of a caricature. It's just not a genre to me that is represented as a very timeless genre.
Yeah.
So I don't criticize any of these artists, you know, for their sound at the time. I think they were right in step or maybe even ahead of the curve, you know, in that time and in that genre. But I think there's definitely other genres and artists that are very timeless that you can pull from this list.
I think that's a fair take on glam or hair metal. It's doing something heavy, but it's doing it in a very pretty way.
Yes, right.
And the aesthetic, you know, I have some metal friends and they're into the virtuosity of metal. And I was always a little bit more punk rock. I like my music a little messy.
Yeah.
You know, so that's why I can appreciate the virtuosity of a Led Zeppelin, but to me it's got a little crunch and it's a little dirtier, you know.
Yeah.
Or like early Van Halen is a different thing than more later 80s and 90s Van Halen, where it cleans itself up. I like the grittier stuff. I like AC/DC. And AC/DC is just kind of nasty. You know, but it's also, I would say it's hard rock. I think it maybe would qualify as metal. What about the other bands? Any other bands you're going to diss?
Anything that was punk did not sit well with me, but that's because I love punk music so much that I can be very picky. So there's only two artists that really fell in that category for me. It was One Bad Pig and Ishmael United. Ishmael United was okay. You're okay.
But you didn't take to One Bad Pig.
No. Not at all.
I tried.
I wanted to.
I do know those guys.
Oh, yeah.
They were, and I would just say, well, obviously in anything, it's all subjective and you can like whoever you like.
Absolutely.
And if you were there at the time, but Daniel Smith tells a great story about One Bad Pig. I think he was at... I think he was at Cornerstone or something and they were there and he didn't see them play, but he wanted their t-shirt so bad. He just thought it was the funniest band name. And this is when Danielson family was, you know, there.
Yeah.
And I think the story is he wrote them and sent them a Danielson t-shirt and then they sent him a One Bad Pig t-shirt.
Oh, that's so awesome.
I don't know that he ever heard the band, but he did really love the name and was so proud of it. Daniel, I'm sorry if I'm messing up that story, but he tells the story that his mom got the thing and was like, "What is that? One bad pig."
I'm sure.
Like, "Mom, it's cool. Don't worry about it. It's cool."
Right, right. It's not supposed to make sense. That's how you know it's cool.
Right. Okay, so once you kind of became aware,
yeah,
in your life of the fact that there was rock music and then there was Christian rock music, did any of it have appeal to you because it was Christian? Did you lean towards the Christian bands you were mentioning because you were a Christian and wanted to listen to them or support them? Or were you just like, you know, I like Weezer, so I'm going to like Weezer, and I don't even think about if these bands are Christian or not?
Yeah, it's a good question. So, I mean, I thought about that, a couple things to it. So, one, you know, my dad didn't, he often expressed that he didn't really feel welcome in kind of just the church circles and just like just the mainstream Christian world. So he always was a bit of an outsider. I think his life would mirror that as well as his feelings. And honestly, I've experienced that most of my life as well, not fitting into kind of the traditional mold. And so because of that, you know, I don't actually have a lot of strong nostalgic feelings for artists, you know, for these Christian artists. I think my nostalgia around the older groups, kind of, you know, the founders, comes from the nostalgia through Larry, you know, like a vicarious nostalgia through him, because it just reminds me of him and trying to understand his youth and his perspective and where he came from. So I think that's what gives me a connection to those older artists.
Were there Christian groups, generally meaning that you had to buy the tape at the Christian bookstore, yeah, I guess, yeah, but yeah. Were there Christian groups that you really felt like by connecting to them as a listener or as a fan or going to the show, that you were kind of being a little rebellious against the mainstream Christian culture, like Christian artists that were like, "Yeah, I know they're Christian, but these are cool Christians," or they're speaking to me.
There were a few, you know, and I know there's a lot of nuances to peer pressure and fitting into your community. Yeah. I think what my peers considered to be rebellious, or at least it wasn't necessarily what was on the K-Love station, would be bands more like 90 Pound Wuss, MXPX, Slick Shoes. Yeah. But that's also because of the time. It's just when the pop punk revolution was kind of happening in both markets. But I think what spoke to me more, but wasn't popular with my peer group, so, you know, my real kind of my secret, joys, were things like, you know, Pedro the Lion or David Bazan. I definitely liked Danielson or Danielson Family. What really resonates with me from the scene was more the section about him talking about, I think Eric's quote was something about, you know, his he loves you know, secular artists that have like a Christian perspective.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And honestly, that's really been where my heart has been since the beginning, because I've always wanted to fit in and belong. And I always resonated with people that were searching for the truth more instead of people professing they knew the truth.
Yeah. Yeah. You and me both.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, Eric's list was U2, The Call, Simple Minds, and other artists. And I listened to all of them and also enjoy them. But my generation would be more like Nirvana, the Pixies. And when you study and read up on these artists, many of them have wounds from Christian culture, or they're curious about it or seeking it at one point in their life.
Oh, yeah.
And you definitely hear it in their music.
Cobain in particular. I think
yes.
He was raised in a Christian home. Became estranged from it at some point. But yeah, isn't that – I mean – I don't know why, and this would be one of those things we'd want to ask Larry if he were with us today.
Yeah.
I think some of that stridency came from honest spiritual conversions, you know, experiences with God that were really true to those folks.
Yeah.
And an understanding, a theological understanding of the world and of the Bible and of who Jesus was that impassioned them. Mm-hmm. And so convince them that, you know, I need to tell people about this, and, yeah. and people need to know and believe with it. That's what it used to mean, I think, to be evangelical.
Yeah.
Would be to evangelize, would be to tell people about the gospel, right? And I think they were so into that, and somehow in that, some of that movement went to a place of just certainty. Mm-hmm. And then some of that movement went to a place where there was a little space for mystery, or a little space for, you know, the Holy Spirit will figure it out, or yeah. God's bigger than your questions, so bring them. And if we don't know the answer, we'll say we don't know. You know, like, and but a lot of it became very strident, even in Christian music.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, because you can dig up songs from the 70s, 80s, 90s, 2000s, even today, yeah. Christian music, where you can just say, lyrically, you can just say, is this artist kidding? I mean, are they this just, you know, rigid and adamant about what they're saying?
Yeah.
And then you can hear others where you're like, whoa, you know, I was just talking to a friend about Bill Maloney of
oh, yeah.
Vigilantes of Love. Bill Maloney is like, he's a Christian, and he's, mm-hmm. you know, it's like Bob Dylan, like poetry.
Yeah.
Sung by Neil Young. If that sounds interesting, you might
want to. I love that. Yeah.
Bill Maloney. But like, that was the stuff that always drew me in. You know, being 17 years old and just sitting in front of the yeah. Joshua Tree lyric sheet and going, yeah. okay, whatever this is, I'm in for this.
I think what's important about music to many of us, especially when we're young, music can really be a lexicon for the heart and the soul. Mm. You know, I think when you're a young person, we're lacking context. We're lacking life experience. We haven't seen the other side. You know, everything is uphill. All we see is a far off mountaintop. Music can either, I think it can guide us, but sometimes it also can affirm our struggles, or it can affirm our excitement. It's just it's a great sounding board and tool of affirmation or guidance to help us navigate up the mountain. And that's why, I mean, and your mood changes with music too, you know? So I think that's why sometimes, especially as a teenager, when your emotions are so up and down, you know, sometimes mm-hmm. you want to hear that song that, that helps you process the grief or the shame of getting turned down by that person you have a crush on, or your relationship ending. And I think other times you feel like you don't have a voice or a place to open up. And so you want music with some aggression and some anger in it, because you need that permission, and you need that amplification to release, you know, that anger and that tension you have within you. And those are just two examples, but I music is still that way for me.
Yeah. Yeah. Me too.
Yeah.
Me too.
So I just think it's a beautiful gift. And to me, that's just one more reflection of God's work in the world. I mean, I think we're surrounded by the mirror of God's image, and we're surrounded by, you know, tools, if you will, or avenues or ways to, express and navigate just all the complexity of our heart and soul. And so, I mean, I just think it's a gift.
I've got spirit, I've got soul, I got some big ideas, I'm out of control. Whoa.
I didn't live with my dad until I was a teenager, and it was really for a small window of time. And when I did, his health was at its worst as well. So it, mm-hmm. there were sweet times to it, but I was also a caregiver. His career was struggling mm-hmm. and he wasn't doing well. I'm sure it was very stressful for him to raise a teenager, especially after
yeah.
not having that one-on-one time with me, the developing years, and especially in Europe, because his career definitely took, you know, a dive in the U.S. by the time I had really come into the picture. But in Europe, the shows were huge. you know, 10, 20,000 people, large festivals.
Wow.
It wasn't even about the crowds, but, you know, as you might know, anyone who's really ever been to a Larry show or seen footage, I would say he talked more than he actually sang. He was clever and he knew how to package a story and a narrative to listeners. And he guarded things to be safe, which is wise. But he really also shared himself. And I think there was things I learned about him from a relational level, just kind of a more personal, intimate level, about who he was just through his concert narratives. I've seen him a couple hundred times, no exaggeration, in person. And I loved every night. And I really did. But I think it was more because I felt like I was sitting around the campfire with him and less that I was seeing a performance. I would pretty much do anything to have one more chance to be on the side of the stage and hear the same joke I heard last week and the same story I heard last week again and again. I would love to do that one more time.
This is David Lohman. We just met because he likes the movie and we found each other on social media.
Yep.
It strikes me that you may be the character that Eric is based on.
That's what everybody's told me when they saw the that one scene. I think it was my wife looked over at me and said, "Do you have all of those?" I said, "No, I have way more than that."
Do you mind if I ask how old you are or how old you would have been in 1986?
In 1986, I would have been about 21.
Okay, so you were old enough to be able to be buying records and have some discernible taste.
Yeah, hopefully.
Also, you were in Orange County, right? You were down in, I know you're from Anaheim.
Yep, so I was in Orange County and I started buying Christian music around 74, 75.
My goodness.
Any bottles that I would find. And, you know, back in the day, you'd take bottles back to stores and you'd get like a nickel or a dime for them.
Yeah.
I would do that. My allowance, I saved everything, did odd jobs, mowed lawns or whatever. And once I got around 10 bucks, I'd find my way to a Christian bookstore.
What was your faith background? How did you come to Christian music?
The best way to describe that is there was once an issue of the old Wittenberg Door magazine that had two pictures side by side of a guy before conversion and after conversion. It was the exact same picture. That was me. I was the token 5-year-old, went to VBS. They said, come, you know, say this inner spirit, whatever it was back when you were 5 in a Baptist church and you just did what you were supposed to do. And then faith became a little more real when I was about 10, 11, and 12 years old. Had a great Sunday school teacher. But I had an older brother, older sister that were in like, back then it wasn't worship bands in a church. You were just in a band.
Yeah.
They would have records and they would forget about those records after a year like most people do. And I would just start collecting their albums that they kind of left. I found, you know, Awaiting Your Reply cassette from Resurrection Band that my sister kind of just stopped listening to and I took it over.
You weren't a Calvary Chapel kid or were
No,
you?
I wasn't a Calvary Chapel kid, but I did go to, I have vague memories of going to concerts in the tent before the building was finished back in the early to mid 70s.
For those listening, that would be the, if you've heard of the movie, The Jesus Revolution, that was the story of kind of, I guess, the start of that ministry, as it were.
Yeah, so I remember seeing Gentle Faith and became a Daryl Mansfield fan overnight because I'd never thought of a harmonica as a rock and roll instrument. But no doubt he could do that. You know, he was one of my original favorites back then with Gentle Faith.
Did you also have Beatles records and Rolling Stones and Led Zeppelin records, or were you purely listening to Christian music?
I was almost exclusively Christian music. I think there was a handful of albums that my brother, when he went off into the Air Force or whatever, that were kind of left behind, like Elton John.
Okay.
I remember one of the earliest ones that I had was Eric Clapton's, the Ocean Avenue album. The one that had Motherless Children. I just remember that right away as one that I owned early on, Jim Croce. But for the most part, the music that made it into my parents' house usually had a Gaither name attached to it.
Yeah, mine
maybe
too.
Evie.
Mine too.
but that was about it, that, except for the stuff that my brother would sneak in. Although I do remember buying my first mainstream album with my own money, and it was the Rossington Collins Band after the plane crash that impacted Lynyrd Skynyrd. And I remember buying that album for some reason, don't know why. But for the most part, outside of that one time that my mom didn't know that I sent a penny to the Columbia Music Company, and then she got a bill for $17.99 a month. most of what I was buying was usually just at Christian bookstores.
You just mentioned something really interesting that a lot of people don't know. The place where these records and tapes were being bought were Christian bookstores. Yeah. There was a Christian book publishing industry that was pretty robust.
Very much so.
And that's where the Christian music labels started putting the product, presumably, I guess, because they couldn't get it in the regular stores.
None of them really had that kind of a mainstream public. I do know that there were a handful. Impact was a label that Larry Norman was on. And they found a way with distribution, I think MCA back in the day, but it was pretty sparse. I mean, you could walk into 10 mainstream record stores, Licorice Pizza, Warehouse, and maybe find 20, 30 different albums. And it's usually just the biggest names. It would be an Evie, a Gaither, but you weren't finding Love Song or Gentle Faith, or let alone Parable or Resurrection Band.
Your love for this music, your interest in this music, did this crossover to school? Were you making tapes for friends at school?
Oh, yeah, all the time.
Friends at school.
all the time. Especially by the time I could drive and could drive to Calvary Chapel every single Saturday night. When I turned 16, I had two friends that also turned 16 within a month of each other. And we would take our dates to Calvary Chapel on a Saturday night for a concert constantly. Usually once a week, my friends would say, oh, what's new? Because by then, by the time I was 16, I'd already been working at a Christian bookstore. Got hired as a 15-year-old at a Christian bookstore. Remember bringing Jerusalem's third album, Warrior, to school. I was part of leadership in middle school. They would have the leadership class, which was pretty much just the screw-off class for 45 minutes. And then every once in a while, you had to do a project or, make a sign for a football game. And we could bring our music in. And I just remember the only thing that I could bring in constantly was the After the Fire album, because that was the only thing that they would actually put on of my music if I wasn't the first one in there. But they would definitely play that because everybody knew Der Kommissar.
That's right. And a lot of people who know Der Kommissar don't know that there was a faith element to After the Fire.
Oh, yeah, very much so.
When you saw the scene in the movie and Eric says the bands, what were a couple of the bands when you're like, these guys did their research. This is for real.
In the world of professional wrestling, they call it popping big. You just get super excited when you hear it. Andy McCarroll and the Moral Support. Ishmael United. I think those are Bill Mason Band. Some of those European imports are ones that really kind of popped me, because I was like, oh, wow. Rob Castles, who I know also snuck his way onto a handful of scenes. These were not on major labels. These were very difficult to find. Pilgrim America label, some of the stuff that came over from the UK. Bill Mason was on, I think, Chapel, but then somehow Star Song picked it up in the United States about a year after they, I think, had already broken up in Europe. But those are the sort of bands, I think, Trouble, I kind of popped for big time. Just because I had heard about it, and I was one of those kids, and this is, I think, one of the that shows I'm a lot like Eric. I would go into a mainstream secular store and I would thumb through, and if it had a cross or the name of the band sounded like it could be Christian or have any connotation. Yeah. And I remember I think it was Trouble's first album or something like that was called Psalm 9. And you're like, oh, wait, it's actually a psalm. Oh, I'm going to get it. As a 14, 15 year old kid, I've never been so terrified in my entire life listening to music. The first time I heard Trouble, I mean, that doom, dark metal, nothing in Christian music was even close. I mean, Saint was the heaviest, and they were not even close to what Trouble was doing. So those are some of the bands that really kind of popped for me. And then when he started listing some of the early ones, those were kind of fun as well. Yeah. All Saved, Freak Band. I mean, in Southern California, we knew them because they would play Calvary occasionally, or they were pretty much, you could go to any park in Riverside County or Orange County. And if they had like a little amphitheater shell, a Christian band was playing on a Saturday. It happened all the time.
Wow.
That's how I discovered Lifesavers and Altar Boys before they put their first album out.
Man, I grew up in South Carolina, like the kid in the movie. And I was obsessed with everything Orange County, everything from, you know, surf and skate culture to like the Christian bands, that generation of Christian bands. We thought those were just the coolest. And so when I meet people who are like, oh yeah, I saw Undercover like 12 times. We were just like, oh, we would have died to see Undercover.
Some of us had to be 12 times a month because they literally were everywhere. But I remember just some of the stuff that was considered so controversial then is now so tame. Yet at the same time, you go way back and Larry Norman talks about gonorrhea on Valentine's Day and you're still looking for the perfect leg. Nobody could record that lyric today.
That's right.
It's almost
we
went far and then we went so far back that Christian music wouldn't allow a line like that. And yet he wrote that in 1971.
Gonorrhea on Valentine's Day, BD. And you're still looking for the perfect leg. You think rock and roll will set you free, honey. You'd be dead before you're 33. Shooting junk till you're half insane.
So I was working at, I'd hired at 15 at a Christian bookstore in Orange, California, which the weird name, it was called The Pink Lady. And people would say, oh, so what do you do, the 9:30 show? But it was technically, it was an ice cream shop that every time that one of their places next door to them closed, they kind of just took it over. So they had this little area to eat in the back and then no one was ever using it. So they said, oh, let's put some gift cards in there. Some Hallmark cards. Well, the place next door went out of business, so they made a Hallmark store. So they started putting Christian books and gifts back in that same little area, and the place next door to them closed, and they said, okay, well, let's put Christian books and gifts. And then finally, they started putting Christian music in there back in the late 70s, and then the place two doors down closed, and so they took that over and put music. So it ended up being a really large store, and to go full circle, they took all of the rock music and put it back inside that little area, the little eating area. And that's what they had me manage. So I was in charge of the rock garage and just kind of built a reputation of people coming in. My boss would always joke that people would come into the store, ask if Dave was there. And if he wasn't, they'd just say, oh, I'll come back later. Because they knew to ask me what it was that was new and hip and fun. I was pretty fearless. I would just like walk into recording studios when I knew that somebody was recording and I'd knock on the door and I'd tell them who I was and I worked at a Christian bookstore and just wanted to see what the album was like or whatever. And it was amazing how they would just, you know, bring me in and say, hey, listen to this. So we started this friendship. So I decided to do a one-day album signing party with every band that I can invite. And we ended up with over 20 bands showing up. Daniel Amos, Bloodgood, Lifesavers, Altar Boys, Undercover, you name it. If it was an OC band in 85 or so, they were all there. And it was crazy. We had lines out the door. Guardian before they were Guardian. Holy Soldier before they were called Holy Soldier. We had all of these little indie bands that you would see on those like Heaven's Metal compilation type things. It looked like a scary event, but that really blew things up so that when Brian Tong left Maranatha Village to go start Frontline Records with Jimmy Kempner, the pastor at Calvary Chapel, who used to do the Saturday night shows, the next day I got a phone call from the owners of Maranatha Village, which was at the time considered one of the biggest and best Christian bookstores in the country. It was a block away from Calvary Chapel. We did more business in the 2 hours after Sunday service at Calvary Chapel in those 2 hours than we did the rest of the week.
Wow.
It was crazy. I would order, let's say a new Undercover album came out. I was ordering 1,500.
Incredible.
We actually got the To Hell With The Devil album a day early from Stryper because of my relationship with them back then. And so we got the real cover with the four angels and the real cover, not the Benson Music cover. And we had over 5,000 people show up that night. And those guys stayed the whole time. It was crazy. The line went down and around the block and down the other block. And it was almost a mile long to get through the store. And eventually Benson Music came calling because they wanted someone to sell Frontline that had a real idea how to sell what Frontline was doing.
Oh, right. Yeah.
So they hired me to take over like the East Coast and started working for them when I was like 23 years old. I was a little kid. And I remember my first sales conference when I got probably my first real lesson in the music industry. They were pitching us a new Dana Key from DeGarmo and Key solo album. And they were talking about, hey, we're going to put a cover on it. We think I could really, you know, just a cool cover song. And I'm all, and they played it. And I said, wait, that's like a DeGarmo and Key song. Why would you cover your own song on your album? I mean, it sounds like you anyway. It's not even like Eddie sang that song. It's Dana singing a song he had already sung on a DeGarmo and Key album. And so they took it to heart eventually, but they didn't like the fact that I was 23 and said it probably not in the kindest way. I think my exact words were, are you guys running out of songs there at Forefront? and so what happened is he ended up covering The Outlaw by Larry Norman, and it became Dana's biggest hit as a solo artist.
What's your feeling about like how Christian music, a lot of people say that when it started, it was pure and really good. And then at some point in the 80s, it got a little too commercial and maybe a little bit of loss in quality around the edges, maybe all over. And then we get into the 90s and there's some really good Christian stuff, but it kind of then just, that's when the split happens. It kind of becomes worship music and bands that are Christians just become bands of Christians instead of Christian rock bands as we knew back then. Is that how you see the trajectory of that, or do you have a different view on it?
I have, a much more positive view of what was going on, especially in the 80s. Yeah. I don't know how well you know John Smeeby at all, Smeeby. He is going to be doing like a documentary on what they call like the second or third wave of Jesus music. And he and I have had a couple conversations, and one of them involved the fact that I really believe that there was a second Jesus movement in the early 80s with Lifesavers, Undercover, Altar Boys, The Lifters, and there were a lot of other bands that only got maybe one song on a sampler. I think the lack of purity that people put towards it is that the industry got more involved, but the industry, I've yet to meet an artist that ever said, well, they made me change my lyrics. They always like to say that, I've never known one that has ever told me, no one's ever bothered me to do it. I think some of the most brutally honest stuff comes from straight from the Christian music industry, like what Mike Rowe does with the 77s. I mean, those first few albums are brutally honest. I think every generation likes to look at their generation as being like the good, nice, and pure one. And then, you know, the generation they're currently in is like, oh, well, you know, we kind of have lost it. I think the only thing that really, and you alluded to it, that really hurt per se was that stark division between what was worship music or modern worship music and what was kind of everything else got lumped into it, into this other thing. And I think the loss of Christian bookstores hurt more than anything else. It's not just me. There were hundreds of me's all over the place that were in Christian bookstores and loved the music, loved to share it with people, had a super diverse. I would be listening to Vengeance Rising, and the next album I pulled out was Mark Hurd's Mosaics. There was such a diversity among Christian music fans. There's such a diversity of listeners of what we listen to. And it wasn't that the artist actually says, oh, I'm a Christian and I'm making this music, but did people like me embrace them when their albums came out? So like Indigo Girls, a handful of Christian radio stations played them and loved that first album.
Yeah. When I saw you post that first album, I remember being in college when that came out, and I can remember thinking, hey, I think these guys may be Christians.
Yeah. So, I mean, bands like Simple Minds or the Waterboys, because everyone kind of knows the U2 and the Alarm and the Call, but there were a handful of other bands out there that people really gravitated to. And some of the more aggressive, like Christian rock shows would kind of weave some of these songs in there, and places like Maranatha Village or True Tunes, John's store, would carry some of these albums that were definitely fringe, whether it should be considered or not. But it was because we were hungry for anything that was modern and legitimate to then also have a strong spiritual and biblical sort of connection.
When you think back, do you feel like the old guy saying, you know, sitting around with the grandkids saying, yeah, once upon a time, there was a band called Mad at the World. What does that stuff mean to you now?
Yeah, you know, what's kind of interesting to me is that I listen to the music from today, and I can find just as many artists that are as incredibly appealing, that I am as emotionally attached to, as I was to Steve Taylor, Lifesavers and Undercover. There's a guy here in Portland, but he has a good name nationwide, named Josh Garrels. I think the stuff Josh does is amazing. So I think that there are those things, but I will say, I think it's harder to find them today just because you have to know what you're looking for and you have to know where to dig. Where before, you could walk into a Christian bookstore.
Water swelled from fountains and then turned to wine. Rocks fell from the mountains in a chorus line. He came in tails and top hat and he looked so fine. Yes, the sun began to rain.
Electric Jesus is available wherever you stream movies. Check the links in the show notes to find the award-winning film, the soundtrack, a merch table filled with cool EJ stuff, and links to our guests and their work. If you enjoy the podcast, please be sure to rate and subscribe to it on your preferred player, and check out all the amazing extras we curate on the Electric Jesus YouTube page. Thanks for listening.
Everything is ending like it first was planned. Did you
and, Kaja? That's what was left after the lead singer left Kaja Goo Goo. It's way cooler.